You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the young women who were kidnapped by the at least one of the brothers Castro, maybe all three, time will tell. I mean, we're still figuring this stuff out. The stories are dribbling out about people in the community. The one fellow who was interviewed, he was like, oh, I knew the guy. I used to have barbecues with him. I had no idea. But there's other people who said, there was a time I saw that naked girl crawling around in the backyard in chains, and I called the police. And there was that time I saw that little girl with a baby up in the window yelling at me or waving at me, and I called the police. And the police are saying, we never got those calls, and it's getting very confusing there in Cleveland. And, you know, I'm sure on Cleveland Talk Radio, the big topic is, you know, is the police chief covering his butt, or are people coming forward with stories just to get, you know, their name in the press so that they can, some of the press will pay for stories, you know, this the old British tabloid, oh, here's $10,000, give us an exclusive, and then, you know, boom, it's on the New York Post or something. I don't know if the Post pays for stories or not, frankly, but you get the point of how it works. So you've got these two sides basically alleging malice on each the other's side. And we'll see how that all shakes out. But the thing that I find interesting is that during this era, this post 9/11, post Bush era, when our police departments are being flooded with money for high-tech equipment, for machines that create such a loud squeal that it knocks people down to their knees, pepper gas, Mutant Ninja Turtle outfits so that they can, basically terrorize neighborhoods, super SWAT teams, something pretty much didn't even exist 30 years ago, where now, you know, at least once a day in America, a door is kicked in and a house is invaded by police, and it's the wrong door in the wrong house. This happens several hundred times, 400 or 500 times a year in the United States. During a time when so many of the high tech and our police departments are ordering drones, and the New York City Police Department has a giant nerve center with 12 giant flat screen TVs monitoring television networks all around the world with simultaneous translation by translators who are watching this is New York City Police. While all this is going on, the Department of Justice, you know, just the good old Department of Justice, the DOJ, came up with this program a few years back, and I'm not sure exactly when it started, but it's been going for a while. 60 Minutes did a piece on it a couple of weeks ago, actually. It's called the COPS Program. Community-oriented policing services. It started in 1994. It started during the Clinton administration. Thank you, Shano. And this program, which the Republicans in Congress in the 2012 budget cut by $119 million, this is the good old-fashioned cops on the streets. Remember Clinton saying, you know, I put 100,000 extra cops on the street? That's this program. And what it is literally beat cops. I mean, it's just like being out on the street. It's none of this high-tech stuff, none of the drones and all this other fancy stuff. I mean, they talk about, you know, their mission. And, you know, the whole point of, you know, what it is, what this COPS program is. And there's three parts of it. Number one, community partnerships, which, by the way, the goal is to increase trust in police. So, you know, you have community collaborative partnerships between law enforcement and local organizations to help develop solutions to problems and increase trust in police. Organizational transformation, changing the way the police department's running so it's more involved in the community, more interwoven in the community, less insulated from the community. Increasing transparency, increasing organizational structure. And problem solving. And the bottom line of all this, this budget has been cut by 75% from 2010 to 2012. As I said, it was cut $119 million last year, 14.4%, by Republicans in Congress. I'm guessing it's probably being cut more right now by the sequester. But you just have to wonder, these young women who have been missing for 10 years, if there had been cops on the street, like in the old days, you know, I mean, back when the cops used to just walk the beat and you knew the officer's name. Oh, yeah, that's Barney Fife. Hey, Barney, how you doing? And people would be more willing to say, you know, I saw something kind of weird the other day over at that Castro house. You know, could it be that the conservative efforts to destroy Bill Clinton's community policing program, cops program, you know, one of the first things George Bush did was, you know, in the Bush administration was roll back that, you know, Clinton's 100,000 extra cops on the streets. Like I said, we've seen a 75% cut just in the last couple of years. Could it be that if Clinton's program had been in place before Clinton put it in place and it had continued in place up until now, that this guy would have been nailed a long time ago? Or that these young women would have been found a long time ago? It seems to me that we have a real problem in the United States of our communities and our police being disconnected from each other. And, I mean, you know, we give lip service to our, well, I give lip service, I guess I'd say, to, you know, the idea of, you know, it's our government, it's us. But increasingly, it's becoming remote, which fuels the fans and fuels the fires of conservative paranoia and the whole Glenn Beck, Alex Jones thing, and government's coming to get you, and government's of them, and the 44% of Republicans who think maybe armed revolution is what we have to do next. And this was a genuine effort by the Department of Justice to reverse that remoteness. Shouldn't we be, and maybe this can be a wake-up call. I mean, there's a lot of issues that you can spin off from this, whether it's, you know, Elizabeth Smart talking about her experience, and we mentioned that yesterday, to the whole slut-shaming, misogynistic culture thing, which we talked about extensively yesterday. But the more I think about this, the more it seems to me that, you know, there's always going to be sickos in our society. There's always going to be sociopaths. This guy, you know, this man or these three men were clearly sociopaths at the best and just plain old evil at the worst. And I'm of the opinion that community policing may have gone a long way toward preventing this kind of thing, and I don't understand why it is that conservatives are so opposed to community policing and so gung-ho for high-tech policing, unless it's just that they're being funded by the big, you know, the war machine companies that sell the high-tech stuff to the high-tech cops.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Like the whole war room and the SWAT teams in New York City and the rapid response, all that involves millions of dollars worth of equipment. Maybe that's why the Republicans are gung-ho for it. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. And in addition to this whole, and my take on this, the COPS program, Bill Clinton's program to do more community policing, which the Republicans have aggressively been cutting back on over the last couple of years, which I think, you know, more of that kind of thing might have been useful in perhaps preventing or catching quicker this whole situation in Cleveland. In addition to this, today, the other big story, as it were, out of the day today, is that Daryl Issa is on his high horse in Washington, D.C. here, holding hearings, trying to, in my opinion, trying to sully, trying to knock around Hillary Clinton so that to make her a less viable presidential candidate in 2016. That's just my personal opinion. But Hayes Brown is the national security reporter and a blogger over at Think Progress, the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, thinkprogress.org, wrote an absolutely brilliant piece today, Why There Won't Be Anything New in Today's Benghazi Hearing. Hayes, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us. So why won't there be anything new in today's? I mean, you actually, the hearing's about half over. I'm sure you've been keeping track of it.
At least half over. It's being a bit of a trek right now to get through this.
Yeah. So what was the point of these hearings, and why is there actually nothing new in them?
Well, the point of these hearings, as it always been with Benghazi, is purely political. If Republicans really wanted to get the heart of the issues that were affecting the State Department and why the tragedy in Benghazi was going to happen, they easily could. Instead, what we've seen is a three-ring circus from the House Oversight Committee, headed by ringmaster Republican Daryl Issa and Jason Chaffetz of Utah. And instead of asking, you know, the hard questions about what could we do to prevent the next attack, we've been focusing on the past and pointing fingers and throwing blame around, and it's just really not productive. So, of course, there's nothing new that was really going to be uncovered today.
Yeah. Well, I'm a big advocate of looking into the past. I'd like to know, Bonnie Sauter, the president of Iran, just 3 weeks ago in the Christian Science Monitor published a piece, the president of Iran in 1980, saying that the Reagan administration or that the Reagan campaign had cut a deal with the Ayatollah to hold the hostages. And when he became president in the middle of 1980, he was not allowed to release the hostages because the campaign, the election hadn't happened yet. I would love to know more about that. The LBJ tapes were just released 3 years ago, where we now know that Nixon blew up the negotiations in 68 that LBJ had successfully completed to end the war in Vietnam in 68 so that he could beat mm-hmm. Humphrey. There's a lot of little, I don't have a problem with looking at the past if there's something to look at. But it sounds like what you're saying is that there's nothing to look at here.
That's really correct. What we've seen happen so far is the Senate has put out its own report on what happened in Benghazi. The State Department convened what's called an accountability review board. Mm-hmm. This was headed by Ambassador Thomas Pickering, a very famous, very well-known ambassador, as well as former Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff Michael Mullen, to look into what happened and make recommendations for the future. But Republicans have called that report not credible, not legitimate, and they have not really acted as quickly as you would expect to enact the things that would be that the board said would be necessary to prevent a future incident.
Now, all over the Drudge Report is this, there's this secret witness and this guy who's going to bust the whole thing open, and the administration has been trying to shut him up, and today mm-hmm. he's going to testify. Daryl Issa is going to have the guy, the whistleblower. Blow the whistle. What's the story?
Well, if it's a whistle, it must be a dog whistle, because it's really hard to hear exactly what they were talking about. The witness in question was the deputy chief of mission, the number two guy in Libya at the time of the Benghazi attack. But what we've seen is actually that most of what he said is things that we've already known, or he's putting forward theories that have been debunked. Like he said beforehand that he believed that if only F-16s had flown over Benghazi, done a flyover buzz, then the second wave of the attacks, which started several hours after the first, could have been prevented. But the military said repeatedly that there were no air assets within range of Benghazi at the time. They would have arrived after all of the fighting had done, not just the first wave, but the second wave as well.
Right. Right. Benghazi, of course, for those who don't remember, is the it was not an embassy. It was a mission. Is that the word?
Yes.
Sort of a remote office of the embassy where our ambassador and an aide of his and two security guards were murdered on 9/11, oddly, or not 9/11 of this last year. Where are the Republicans going to go with this? I mean, have they found any there? Have they got anything to pull on?
That's a great question. They seem to be trying to slip gotchas in towards the administration. They're trying to say that Hillary Clinton said that she had no idea that more security is requested for Benghazi, but they have her signature on all the documents. But it turns out the documents that come from the State Department say Secretary of State at the bottom, whether they were reviewed by Clinton or not. That's just typical State Department protocol, which if they had bothered to ask around, the House Republicans would know this.
Maybe they already knew it. Maybe they just maybe they're just trying to get stuff in the record that will make good ads in 2016.
Entirely possible, because there's nothing really new being uncovered here today.
When this started, Jason, or Hayes, I'm sorry, Hayes Brown, when this started, I was of the opinion that they were going to try and use this to impeach President Obama. I thought this was, you know, Daryl Issa going after Obama. Increasingly, it's looking like he's going after Hillary Clinton. Like, you know, Obama's already, you know, he's old, he's history. Let's take down the next Democrat. You think I'm out of something here?
I think that former Secretary of State Clinton is definitely being targeted in these hearings. What their end goal is, it's hard for me to say.
Yeah. But your sense of it is that it's political rather than
practical. It's definitely political rather than practical, these hearings. If they really wanted to uncover the truth, there are ways of going about these hearings other than what we've seen so far.
Yeah, okay. Hayes Brown, national security reporter, and a brilliant one, and blogger at thinkprogress.org. Thanks, Hayes.
Thanks for having me.
Great talking with you. 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, cops, what do we do about the community policing program? Might that have helped? And thoughts on Benghazi, if you want. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where despair is not an option. We are transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Apropos of, you know, I asked the question of Hayes Brown, who has really done some great research on this stuff and has been doing a fine job, a great job of following that small-time criminal, Daryl Issa, who is now the richest or second richest guy in the House of Representatives. In any case, following his activities with regard to this whole so-called Benghazi thing. This is what Mike Huckabee, who was once a governor and is now a talk show host who's out loud thinking about quitting talk show hosting. I don't know, maybe nobody's listening to him, but whatever. He says, I believe that before it's all over, actually, let me finish the setup on this. I asked Hayes Brown, I said, you know, I started out thinking that this whole Daryl Issa witch hunt was to trash Obama. And now I'm thinking that it's to trash Hillary Clinton. Maybe it's a twofer. Because here's what Mike Huckabee had to say. And you realize, you know, this is the right-wing echo chamber. You know, these guys are all talking to each other. They're all getting the same emails. They're all, you know, working with the same think tanks. He says, I believe that before it's all over, this president, he's speaking about Obama, he said this on Monday. He says, I believe that before it's all over, this president will not fill out his full term. This isn't minor. It wasn't minor when Richard Nixon lied to the American people and worked with those in his administration to cover up what really happened in Watergate. But I remind you, as bad as Watergate was, because it broke the trust between the president and the people, no one died. This is more serious because four Americans did, in fact, die. So that's going to be the right-wing meme. The president lied and somebody died. Now, if they try putting it in those terms, I would be surprised, actually, if they tried putting it in those terms. Because if any Republican said to me, the president lied and four people died, I would say George Bush. All right, that president lied and hundreds of thousands of people died. But beyond that, it doesn't look like, you know, the president lied about anything. Hillary Clinton didn't lie about anything. This is just nothing more than a political hit job. So there's that. We've got that. We've got this community policing thing. I think the community policing thing is actually pretty important. So Henry in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Henry, what's up?
Yes, this is Las Vegas, New Mexico.
New Mexico. I'm sorry.
Yes. Very small prairie town.
I guess so.
Yes. But first of all, my father was a policeman in Europe and on the beat, and he could practically smell what was going on. And second place, I would like to switch over to Japan, where they have almost on every street corner a little kiosk with two or three officers, and they know every grandmother who lives on their block.
Yeah. So in Europe, your father's experience was he was a cop on the beat and he got to know everybody. I mean, this is the old, you know, the old Boston Irish cop on the beat. You know, the you read the old detective novels from the 30s and the 40s, and then, you know, the cops, everybody knew everybody. And in Japan, they do this. In the United States, not so much. So you're agreeing with me, Henry, that if we were to do more of what Bill Clinton started in 1994, this COPS program, the community outreach program, this it's called Community Oriented Policing Services Program, that these four girls might not have, or these three young women might, and maybe a fourth, might not have been kidnapped.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay.
The kiosks, as I say, in Japan, you walk, you come out of a train station, and you stand right in front of the kiosk. And we were looking for, all the hotels were full. There was a symposium. My wife is Japanese, so she speaks the language. We walked right into the booth and explained the situation, and they said, don't go to that hotel, but go to this one. The prices are better, and it is safer and cleaner. And so it was just like talking to the local tourist service.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
On top of that, as I say, my father in Europe was walking the streets with a bicycle, and he was walking next to his bicycle.
Hmm.
When there was a need to jump on the bike to catch something, he would do so. But most of the officers, almost all of the officers, when I grew up there, were walking next to their bike.
Fascinating. And they knew what was going on in their communities. Henry, thank you for sharing that story with us. And thank you for watching Free Speech TV there on Dish Satellite Network in Las Vegas, New Mexico. I appreciate the call. John in Columbus, Ohio, watching us on live stream. Hey, John, you used to live in Cleveland?
Yeah, I did. I lived in Cleveland pretty much my whole life growing up, and then for a little while after college, right near the area where Amanda Berry was found in Tremont. So I was just, five or seven blocks from there.
Whoa. And what's your sense of that area and whether or not community oriented policing services might have been a useful thing?
Well, growing up, I know that area was not doing so well economically. So Cleveland police might have tended to stay away from it or sent in the CMHA, the Metropolitan Housing Authority police. But outside of that, recently the Tremont area in Cleveland over the past, I would say, 7 to 10 years has really experienced a lot of economic revitalization, and now it's probably a lot safer for the police to go in and start patrolling even on foot or on bikes.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I would pass through there through the main drags in Tremont, you really wouldn't see very much.
Yeah.
By contrast, though, I now live in Columbus, Ohio, and the Metropolitan Police are fantastic. If I need to call them, they're available within 5 minutes, even for a minor issue.
Yeah. Well, Columbus has much more of a, well, first of all, it's the capital city. So, you know, typically capital cities have more resources just because the legislators are there and they make sure that that happens. Correct me if I'm wrong. Columbus is the capital of Ohio, right?
Oh, yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, okay. And it's a great college town. And secondly, it's kind of got that more of a feel of a small town than Cleveland. But so your experience of living in the area where these girls were abducted was that the cops just basically never showed up.
Yeah, or they only showed up if there was somebody waving a gun.
Yeah, okay. John, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Joe in Atlanta, Georgia, listening on SiriusXM. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, it's really a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks for the call.
I've been listening to you for a long time. It's great to get in and talk to you. Real quick, you know, I grew up in Tampa, and I survived the Reagan drugs being flooded into the inner city. I lived in a very dangerous neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a police officer that really tried to make a difference, but it was really tough because it was just her.
Hmm.
And they were spread very thin, and there was a lot of cocaine coming into Tampa.
Yeah.
to Bob Martinez. But anyway, my point is on the other side is I think people would want to be a cop if they didn't have to sit in their squad car and hand out tickets all day. If they were involved and they knew their community and they knew the people around, I think it would be a good it would attract people to do that profession. I wouldn't want to be sitting in a squad car all day, you know, basically policing traffic.
You know, the first job that I actually remember telling one of my brothers that I wanted to do when I was growing up, and I must have been 5 or 6, I was a little kid, was being a garbage man. And the reason why was because, you know, I'd sit in our living room in the morning. We'd sit and watch the cartoons, you know, before our parents got up on the weekends. And the garbage guys would come by and collect the garbage. And so I saw people at work. And, you know, they were outdoors and they were, you know, these big burly guys and they were moving stuff around. They were doing things and they seemed to be having a good time and they talked to each other. And I thought, oh, that looks like fun. And maybe I'd like to be a garbage man. Now, you know, I mean, it'll probably last a few weeks, but my desire for that. But the point is that if kids in particularly in the rougher neighborhoods grew up knowing a local police officer, knowing the cop on the beat, knowing the Andy of Mayberry local guy, or even the Barney Fife local guy, they might want to grow up to be police officers more than they do right now. Because right now it seems like there's not a lot of people coming out of tough areas going into police academies. Does that make sense?
Why would somebody want to get that job? It's to help people, or
right.
You would think.
Right.
You know, but at the day, there's not, you know, the best way to make money as a cop is when you get off work and you work at a nightclub, or if you work at a bar or something like that, because they make double the pay.
Tragically, yes.
Off, you know, there's not enough cops, and they don't get paid enough.
Yeah.
It's like posting, you know, or I mean, it seems like everybody is demonizing teachers, cops. I mean, this is what makes our society work.
I agree. Our teachers are our future and our cops are our present, and we are underpaying and trashing the fact that both are generally unionized and trashing them and their jobs constantly. And I'm totally with you, Joe. And this is why I thought that. I was a big supporter of Bill Clinton's COPS program, his community-oriented policing services. I'm astounded that Republicans for the last 2 years have been radically cutting back on funding for this, taking these police officers off the streets, and you know, and instead ramping up things like, oh, let's get more high-tech laser sights. And I think it's because they're taking money from the companies that make the high-tech laser sights, not because they're concerned about our communities. Joe, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to us in Atlanta. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So I'm curious, do you think with regard to Benghazi, that Daryl Issa is going after Obama, that he's going to try and impeach him, or that this is all about Hillary Clinton? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Carl Gibson on the line with us. He is the lead organizer for Shut the Chamber, shutthechamber.org, and we're not talking about chambers like the Star Chamber or the Music Chamber. Carl, tell us about Shut the Chamber.
Sure. First off, Tom, thanks for having me on the program. It's an honor.
It's a pleasure.
As far as Shut the Chamber goes, this is I'm sorry, Tom?
I said it's a pleasure. No, it's a pleasure to have you here. Go for it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Shut the Chamber is basically a campaign to go after not just Congress, but the people who are pulling the strings in Congress, so to speak, the puppet masters. Everybody knows that Congress is bought and paid for by big corporations. They listen to lobbyists over constituents. You know, they listen to campaign donors over voters. Everybody knows that. So what this campaign is about is targeting the root cause of the problem, which we see is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They're the number one lobbyist in Washington. They've spent the most money on lobbying in the last several years. And they're the main reason why Congress is failing to act on jobs legislation, on climate change, on a number of issues that Americans care about. The U.S. Chamber is spending millions of dollars to make sure that the corporate agenda is at the top of the list.
So you want to shutthechamber.org is the website. I'm guessing you don't actually think you'll be able to end the existence of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but at least stop the the effectiveness or reduce the effectiveness that they have in buying and corrupting our political process. How are you going about doing that, Carl Gibson?
Sure. You know, what this campaign is about is we're going to build a coalition of loyal customers of local small businesses, as well as local small businesses in a number of towns across the country, to collectively organize to divest from state and local county chambers of commerce that in turn pay dues to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And so over the long term, we plan on depriving the U.S. Chamber of Commerce of the funds that they need to lobby Congress, to influence elections, and do all the other evil things that they do. So this is definitely a long-term campaign. But what we're about to do is launch our direct action phase of this campaign, which is essentially leading a march of the unemployed from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., and holding the chamber accountable for essentially buying off Congress and rigging the game, so we have to pay for their crisis. So that's what's going to happen next weekend.
That's great. People can learn all about it over at shutthechamber.org. Carl Gibson, the lead organizer. Carl, thanks for being with us today.
Sure. Thanks, Tom, and keep up the great work of what you guys are doing as well.
Thanks. Great talking with you. I truly appreciate it. Just FYI, your Skype is starting to break up. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. This hurts me, but I agree with you.
This hurts you?
Yeah. Well, I usually like to call in and debate you, but that's okay.
I see.
I don't agree with you, but what I'm saying is let's utilize, free market principles and do the same thing that we do, let's say, with water distribution. In other words, there's a reason why people don't leave the water tap on. They get a bill.
Right.
So we keep our regular police and call them police, and then we hire, on a low-bid basis, security. And their necessity to have security is based upon the crime rate of the area. And, in other words, it would be...
So the poorer the area, the more you want to tax them to have police?
No, you're not going to tax the poor area. You're going to tax uniformly, but it will be a direct payment, a direct charge, a monthly charge that you will get for security.
Well, we already have that right now, Carl, or Steve, excuse me. They're called property taxes, by and large, pay for police departments.
Right, but it's kind of muddled up in the budgetary minutia to the point where you can't put your finger on it and you can't, identify it.
Yeah.
If you identify a tax, you'll get less of it.
Well,
so
sometimes.
People will, in other words, you need to get the entire community, the rich people in the community, the poor people in the community, involved in...
See, I really don't think the poor people in a community are going to be more involved in their community if they're paying higher taxes. And frankly, I don't think rich people are either.
Well, I think what we'll wind up doing is actually lowering the tax rate.
Okay, well, I don't see what any of this has to do with the tax rate. I think that we need to change the focus of our policing systems in the United States from becoming more and more of the Mutant Ninja Turtle stuff and the SWAT team stuff and the Swagger TV show stuff and more into Andy of Mayberry stuff. We need more cops on the beat. We need to do like they do in, like our earlier caller said, they do in Japan and Europe, where, the police are walking down the street. You see them. They're there. There's a continuous police presence. It's not a menacing police presence. It's like the local mailman. You know their names. You get to know them.
I agree with that. That's exactly what I'm saying. In other words, you're Mutant Ninja Turtles. You have to fear the turtle.
Right.
When the police show up, then you're in trouble. But, the reason the police are showing up is because the security guy in the Chevy or the Chevelle down the street is the one who's calling the cops.
Yeah, but see, we tried that. I mean, there are, these community awareness programs and, say what? Well, that's where I was going with George Zimmerman when you start saying, okay, well, let's, involve the community. Let's have, community watch programs. You get volunteers like George Zimmerman. You get people, you get wannabe cops. And I'd like to have the cops. I'd like to have the people who are walking around with guns theoretically protecting my community to be people who are well-trained, accountable, well-paid. They have a good job. They're well-rested because they're not pulling a second shift at the bar in the evening as a bouncer in order to make enough money to put their kids through school. Well-paid with a decent pension so that they have a commitment to this job as a lifetime career. And that's how policing used to be, how it is in some communities, how it should be. And Steve, thank you for the call. And have it local. More police local. On a local basis and literally walking around. I mean, if our communities have gotten so big, and when they have, that police have to drive around, well, maybe we just don't have enough police officers.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to our program. We're going to try something here for a second. It should be interesting, entertaining, and enlightening. Is Steve available yet? We're still waiting. Well, Steve Malzberg is a conservative talk show host. His show is on the same time mine is, 3 to 6 p.m. They run it at newsmax.com /live and also on XM, Sirius XM Radio, channel 166.
Hello, Tom Hartman.
And hello, Steve Malzberg. So we are combining our shows and our audiences today.
Yes.
And thank you very much for suggesting this.
I think it's fun. You and I have talked in the past. For those people who don't know, well, I was at WOR, and we would do this. And we could talk about a lot of things. I don't know if the Benghazi hearings impressed you much. So I want to talk about something that my friends at Newsbusters, Tim Graham specifically, did a story on something that you had said.
Yeah,
and it talked about terrorism, and you were arguing that Christianity and Islam each contain what you called a small cult, quote unquote, of persons prone to violent terrorism. One isn't more dangerous than the other. So before we get
I did not say one is not more dangerous than the other.
Oh, you didn't? Okay, so where are the?
Or if I did say that, I misspoke. I mean, it's obvious that there are a whole lot more people in Islam right now who are interested in killing us, particularly after 12 years of George Bush's wars, than there are Christians who are interested in killing abortion doctors or blowing up.
How many abortion doctors have been killed, and by how many Christians?
I haven't been keeping track of that.
Is it two? Or, I mean, it's not hard to keep track.
This is not...
And the Christians who did it, did they say they did it for Jesus? The one or two, were they Christians?
Steve, I've already agreed with you.
My point is that if you want
to make this into a Christian versus Islam thing, then maybe we should be looking at what we're doing in the Muslim world that might be causing this. Why is it that they're interested in killing us and not Canadians? But I thought that the other thing that I thought was particularly interesting was here that got you going was I was saying we got an industry in the United States that kills 500,000 people a year intentionally. The only outcome of tobacco when used as directed is death. And I consider that terrorism, too. I think that, look at what happened in Texas. You got Rick Perry running around going, oh, we're going to get rid of regulations. We're going to have more fertilizer plants blow up. Come here. Isn't it cool? I think that we've got corporate terrorists in this country. And frankly, I'm more concerned about them than I am about Christian terrorists or Muslim terrorists.
There are no Christian terrorists. Again, you talk about abortion doctors.
I think people who bomb abortion clinics are trying to create terror in the minds of people.
I don't know who's bombed abortion clinics. I mean, you talk about it like it's a frequent occurrence or even a multiple occurrence.
The guy who blew up the
abortion clinics being bombed. Now, by the way, there was just an Al-Qaeda plot broken up to bomb the Canadian transit system. So they hate Canada, too.
Well, and Canada, joined us. They joined George Bush's jihad in 2002.
There was no terrorism before that. You see, George.
Not in Canada, really, no.
No, I'm talking about anywhere. All right. Well,
saying if you kick a beehive, you're going to get stung.
Right. So the beehive are like in the Palestinian territory.
And tragically, the situation, you know, the beehive, what we're doing is we're feeding the beehive. In fact, you know, our for a long time, our policies were to, you know, with Saddam Hussein and Iran, we were funding or feeding both ends. We were giving Iran intelligence. We were giving Saddam Hussein chemical weapons.
Ridiculous that is at this point in history. Do you realize how insane that is? You know, they blew up.
If there was no oil in that region, if we hadn't made.
They hit the World Trade Center the first time under Bill Clinton. Do you understand that?
Oh, you're talking about the blind shake. Yeah. And then the huge intelligence failure when George Bush, when the CIA sent a special guy on a special plane down to George Bush, down in Texas in the summer of 2001 and said, hey, special deal, Bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. Bush patted him on the leg, said, okay, you've covered your ass, go back to D.C., and then proceeded to take the longest presidential vacation in the history of the United States.
Right,
and even then was afraid to go back to Washington, D.C., because he knew something was going to be coming down.
That you can't get past George Bush? Have you seen a doctor?
That's really, you know, the ad hominems are really sweet, Steve, but, you know, they're not going to fly.
George Bush.
Why are you not concerned about the fact that we have in this country people who are aggressively working to kill us or to destroy our system, whether it's banksters who have run amok or whether it's tobacco companies that have run amok or whether it's fertilizer companies that are storing up over 1,000 times what Tim McVeigh had and used. And, you know, and this is just like apparently the tip of the iceberg. And yet you continue to say, oh, but, you know, we shouldn't have government looking into these things because government is us, after all. George Washington created. No, actually, you don't say that, do you? You say government is evil.
I've just been responding to you saying George Bush and blowing up abortion clinics. I really haven't said much. Now, what about pressure cookers? Shouldn't we have government regulation and investigate the makers of pressure cookers? They were used in the last bombings.
Is this some kind of joke?
Not if
okay. Well, actually, let's take that seriously. In that pressure cooker, Steve.
Ice cream clog your arteries.
Steve, you asked me a question. Let me answer it. In that pressure cooker was a bunch of powder that came out of fireworks. And back in the 80s, actually back in the late 60s and early 70s, when the left was blowing up things, when Linda Evans and some of these other folks, you know, when the Weather Underground was out.
Obama's buddy, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Bill Ayers and Bernadette Dorn. When they were doing that, there was legislation being proposed that would put a chemical tagant into black powder, gunpowder, smokeless powders, so that you could track it back to its place of origin or its place of sale. And this was fought against by the NRA. And the NRA, and again in 1980, this was proposed. Again in 2001, after 9/11, this was proposed. The NRA, the Republicans consistently fought against this. Had that chemical tagant been in those fireworks, as has been proposed for over 30 years in the U.S. Congress and consistently fought by Republicans and the NRA, had that chemical tagant been in those in that gunpowder, we would have known within 2 hours what the gun shop store owner, or what the fireworks store owner told us. In fact, he showed us the receipt 4 days later, who the guy was who set off the bomb in Boston.
You're saying it would not have prevented the bombing. Thank you for telling me that. And by the way,
it would have allowed us to catch the bomber within a day, and it might have prevented the death of another police officer.
That this has been, if I take you at your word, this has been going on for 30 years. The Democrats have controlled the Congress and the White House many times in many periods over those 30 years. So blame them for not getting
the Democrats have been the ones who have been consistently suggesting that we should have tagants and powder, and the Republicans have been.
Why didn't Obama and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid pass it?
They had control of the House of Representatives and the Senate for 12 weeks. And then Scott Brown got signed in, and there were enough Republicans to have a filibuster.
They had control for 2 years.
For 12 weeks. After that, you had 40 guys, you had 40 votes, Republican votes in the United States Senate, and they could block, and they did block pretty much everything. Okay. They blocked a piece of legislation that would have stopped the tax breaks to companies for outsourcing factories overseas.
Well, so are you suggesting we close McDonald's and Burger King and fertilizer plants?
No, I got no problem with McDonald's or Burger King's, but I think if a fertilizer plant is going to have 1,000 Tim McVeigh bombs in their backyard illegally, that we should know about it?
I got to tell you, Tom, you got to get over your George Bush obsession. Do a New Year's resolution.
You're
now.
Genuinely worried about those government inspectors at the fertilizer factory, Steve?
All right, Tom.
All right.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, Steve Malzberg. And you can find Steve over at Newsmax.com/live and on SiriusXM Radio on channel 166. And we will continue to fight another day. Steve, good talking with you. And I'm guessing Steve is wrapping up talking to his audience right now, too. We were just simulcasting our program 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, what do you think? Who are the bigger terrorists? The fertilizer guy? The tobacco guys? The Muslims? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Mike in Anchorage, Alaska, listening on iHeartRadio. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I was just listening to the last person you were on. I didn't realize he was another radio talk show host, but
yeah.
I vehemently disagreed with him.
Yeah, we were simulcast. His listeners were hearing me, and they're probably calling him right now, telling him what an idiot I am. And my listeners were hearing him, and we thought we'd try it out.
Well, you know, when he was poo-pooing the fact that there's no Christian terrorists,
mm-hmm.
if you're living in a Muslim country and you have drones, U.S. drones, flying over your head that are sent there by U.S. lawmakers that you see on television proclaiming that we are a Christian nation, then yes, I would say from their point of view, there are a lot of Christian terrorists, and they're in the U.S. Congress.
Wow. I wish I had thought of that when I was talking to Steve. That's a brilliant explanation. If you are a Muslim living in a Muslim country and you're being bombed or droned by a country that where the right wingers stand up in Congress and say this is a Christian nation, then you certainly and your brother or sister or daughter or father who is a civilian has died as a result of this, then you are certainly of the opinion that there are Christian terrorists, that there's a whole country full of Christian terrorists. It makes perfect sense. Mike, so well said. In fact, Shano tells me that you're going to get the book, the Tom Hartman Reader. Did you have another point you wanted to make? You started to say something?
I was just going to it went out of my head when you said that.
Okay, well, that's cool. In that case, I'm going to put you on hold, and Danielle, Mike's on line one. Danielle is going to get your name and address, and we'll send you an autographed copy of the Tom Hartman Reader, which actually has a chapter on vegetarianism in it. If you were the guy who was asking about vegetarianism. No, that was the last guy. Yeah. Okay. That was an earlier call. In any case, we'll send you that. Andrew, listening on WWRL in New York City. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, someone should remind Steve Malzberg that President Clinton was inaugurated on January 20th, 1993, and the first attack on the World Trade Center happened on February 26th, 1993, just a little over a month after Clinton was inaugurated in office. And, Malzberg, you know, it was plotted under Bush.
Yeah, now his response to that would be, well, 9/11 was being planned during Clinton's administration. But, you know, at the same time, Clinton was trying to kill bin Laden. You know, he sent Patriot missiles or whatever those missiles were over and blew up one of them.
Exactly. And I'll say that Clinton, like Obama, okay, we caught terrorists under both Democrats, meaning the first attacks, the first terrorist attacks, attackers.
Yeah, we actually caught the blind shake.
We got bin Laden under Obama, right?
Right. Yeah, so the Republicans are not particularly good at catching terrorists.
These Russian guys?
Yeah.
So who fights terror, who fights and gets and kills terrorists better, more? The Democrats, not the Republicans.
Yeah.
They're the ones, the Bushes were the impetus for the terrorist attack. If they didn't start two BS wars, okay, that have siphoned trillions of dollars from our economy, okay, which is the primary reason why, you know, the economy is in the tank, okay, we wouldn't have these terrorist attacks. Take care, Tom.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot, Andrew. Well said. Very well said. And Mike in Fairfax, Virginia. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I
just wanted to call because I think you completely unfairly represent conservative view sometimes. Like, when we talk about police, we both want, I think both conservatives and liberals want police patrolling our communities.
Yes.
The implementation, we disagree. I don't know when it became a federal responsibility to have a federal police state. If the counties in Ohio want more cops, they can raise their property taxes, and they can pay for state, county, and municipal police officers. The federal government should have no role there. Second.
Well, hang on just a second. If you do that, you're going to have a situation where the poor communities have the worst police departments, just like they have the worst schools, and the rich communities have the best police departments and the best schools, and that's not the American dream. I mean, that isn't, and in fact, if you read the Constitution, the last part of Article 1, Section 8, where did my Constitution go? Here it is, right here. Article 1, Section 8, paragraph, sentence 1, you know, the so-called enumerated powers. Congress shall have the power to lay, collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay for the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. I view that, I read that as, you know, if West Virginia can't afford it and New York City can, then let's make sure that West Virginia at least has some minimum standard.
Well, we could debate the general welfare clause, and that would take up most of your show. But I agree with you that taxation should be equal across the states. But if a particular community feels the need to put more cops on the street, they can pay for that. And if you go back over the last probably five decades and look at federal funding to police, it was really only after terrorism became a national fear that the federal government felt obligated to fund first responders. But I don't believe...
I don't think that's true. I mean, you're talking... I mean, this started in 94 during Clinton,
yep.
and people were talking about terrorism in the 60s when they were talking about the Weather Underground, the Sibyanese Liberation Army. In Europe, you had the Grey Hand, you had the Baader-Meinhof gang, you had the Red Brigades, you had the IRA.
I would challenge you, though, to look at the budgets in the New York City Police Department, Chicago Police Department, any big municipality.
Right.
If you go back over the last few decades, the percentage of federal funding they get has climbed every year, year over year.
Oh, sure.
Terrorism is the reason why.
Sure.
And I think that is just such a sham that if those communities want those things, they can pay for those things.
I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that with regard to terrorism. I'm with you on that because most of this is being used, or a lot of this is being used, to buy this super high-tech, you know, very expensive stuff that is being sold by the defense contractors who live around you in Fairfax and around me here in Washington, D.C., in our areas, in these, you know, 35-bedroom mansions, and, you know, run these giant companies that are selling things both to the military and to our police departments, in my opinion. Mike, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. We'll be back 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Could community policing have prevented that kidnapping? And who are the real terrorists in America? Welcome back. Hey, take a walk in New York City. Stroll down a street in Chicago or mosey about in any major city in America or even in the world. In major metropolitan areas and cities, it's nearly impossible to find a patch of land that hasn't been built up and covered with high-rises, skyscrapers, pavement, sidewalk. It's even harder to find signs of nature like grasses, bushes, or trees. But a new study shows that the few trees that do exist in major urban money in major urban areas are worth a ton of money. According to the U.S. Forest Service, trees in cities, in urban areas, hold an estimated value of $50 billion as they provide valuable environmental services like storing carbon. These researchers found that urban trees, city trees, store an estimated 708 million tons of carbon. In addition, researchers discovered that annual net carbon uptake by these trees is estimated at 21 million tons, which translates into $1.5 billion in economic benefits to us. U.S. Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell said in a press release about this study, quote, "With expanding urbanization, city trees and forests are becoming increasingly important to sustain the health and well-being of our environment in our communities. He went on to say, I hope this study will encourage people to look at their neighborhood trees a little differently and start thinking about ways they can help care for their own urban forests. So if you live in a big city, New York, Chicago, any of America's major urban centers, maybe it's time to channel your inner Johnny Appleseed and do a whole lot of good for your environment and community. Plant a tree. Nathaniel in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Nathaniel. You are on the air. Nathaniel?
Hey, how you doing?
Good. So you wanted to say, usually it seems liberals are for tolerance, but I'm not tolerant of Christians, really? I am a Christian.
You know, yes, but the Bible, the Bible, in the Bible, I'm a conservative, and I believe in the Constitution, but I believe I'm a constitutionalist big time, but I think that the Bible says in that for a man and a woman alone to be married, and if, and it doesn't seem like every, like Christians can't get their view across though.
No, actually in the Bible it says that a man can marry several wives and have several concubines. It says that if a man rapes a woman, she becomes his wife in the Bible. It says in the Bible that if a man's brother dies, that that brother's wife becomes his wife. In the Bible, if you want to talk about traditional marriage, biblical marriage, I refer you to Betty Bowers. Go on the internet and Google Betty Bowers Explains Traditional Marriage. It's a short little video, about 4 minutes long, in which she does just an absolutely brilliant job of just laying out what biblical marriage really is. And even during the times of Jesus, there was no discussion, to the best of my knowledge, about having one wife, although Paul said that that might be a desirable thing for somebody who's married. But polygamy was around then, too.
Yeah, but in 1 Corinthians, and Leviticus 18:22 and 1 Corinthians 6:9, it says clearly, homosexuals shall not inherit the kingdom of God.
No, it doesn't.
I'm not bashing. I'm not.
I mean, it doesn't. The word homosexuals is not in the New Testament. Other than maybe John being the disciple that Jesus loved and laying with his head on Jesus' chest throughout the Last Supper. And, you know, to the point where when Peter wanted to address a question to Jesus, he had to address it to John. I mean, that's in the book of John. You can look it up.
Yeah, that's true, but
it seems like they were pretty tolerant of guys getting close to each other, at least more so than most of the homophobes I know would be.
Well, I'm not a homophobe.
I don't think Jesus was either.
Yeah, well, but it's still like I agree with your sense what it says on the concubine stuff, but it says plainly it says that marriage is between a man and a woman.
No, it doesn't. Nathaniel, if you're talking about the phrase where, you know, the two shall be joined together as one and all that, that they quote when they do the marriage ceremonies, I get that. But it doesn't say this is the only way it can happen. It's not a useful argument. It's not, you know, we'll just end it there. Keith. In Arroyo Seco, New Mexico, listening on KBOT. Hey, Keith, there's a dark side to organized policing, community policing?
Yeah. And it turned out that I feed the homeless, and I work with the group Food Not Bombs.
Uh-huh. That's
and
a great group.
All the campaigns that we come across, like we're having one right now where there's a bunch of laws being introduced by the Pensacola, Florida, City Council, and they've provided a template, an anti-homeless template from community-oriented policing services to create like legislation against sleeping outside and what they call quality of life crimes. And this is something that we've had direct impact with community-oriented policing since Clinton started this, and even before that under Reagan there was a precursor to this idea.
Yeah.
And they also provide like catalogs for when they meet with your community. Because I used to be in a merchants association, and they came to us, showed us the catalog for anti-homeless architecture, and then one of the big things that has recently come out of community-oriented policing has been these widespread laws banning or limiting the sharing of free food outside in public.
Yeah.
And because they say it contributes to what they claim are quality of life crimes, which is basically the crime of being too poor to rent an apartment.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, Keith, and I understand that. You know, at the same time, you can get in a car accident and die. It doesn't mean you should never use a car. Just because the community-based or community-oriented policing is being abused to against homeless people, and I agree with you, it is. And in fact, the guy who was the high priest of that was Rudy Giuliani in New York City. I literally, I remember the day as if it was yesterday. It was so shocking. It's just burned into my mind. I was walking down Fifth Avenue, and in the 50s. And this homeless guy was sitting there with a sign that said something like, you know, and he had a dog with him, and he was sitting on the curb or on the, you know, up against a building with a sign that said something like, you know, homeless Vietnam vet, please give me money. And a police officer came up and started kicked the guy over with his feet. I mean, was kicking him. The guy was already laying or was already sitting, you know, but he kicked him over onto the ground and then just started stomping on him. And people were, you know, walking by looking horrified, but nobody tried to do anything, you know, and then another cop came along and they ended up hauling this poor guy off. And that was during the Giuliani administration. That was back in the, what, 80s, I guess? 90s? No, it must have been late 90s, early 2000s. And that's the dark side of it. But that doesn't mean we should put an end to it. It means we should put an end to that practice within it, doesn't it?
Involved in that. Yeah, Frank Jordan in San Francisco was one of the earliest pioneers of that, and he actually was brought to New York to teach Rudy Giuliani how to do his program. And so Frank Jordan in San Francisco's program was called Quality of Life Enforcement Matrix Program.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, we need, and I think you guys with Food Not Bombs are doing a good job of raising consciousness on this. We need to be addressing the issue of homelessness in the United States. We need to be addressing our misplaced priorities with regard to the military-industrial complex and things like that. At the same time, we also need to be addressing the way that our policing is being done. And can we at least agree, Keith, that having local police...
Well, I totally agree with that. And I think the idea, I grew up in Boston and... you know, and I knew my policemen, and I think the idea of actually having local police that you know and talk to, and even during the struggle in San Francisco where we were being beaten for sharing food, we actually had, you know, we spent so much time in custody with police that they became a part of our friends and family, and we, you know, meet them afterwards and stuff.
Yeah, we're all just human beings here.
Police, it's just the taking a good idea, like, you know, that there should be nice people, you know, nice officers that know their communities, that's a great idea. And sadly, people ended up, such a huge percentage of community-oriented policing services ended up being this kind of quality of life enforcement.
Yeah.
And it's just a real shame that something could be...
Yeah, no, I got it. Keith, I need to move along, but thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to KBOT. Doug, listening in Sirius in Sacramento. Douglas, we have a minute to the break. It's all yours.
Okay, thank you. It's good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I met you on the Hornblower cruise in San Francisco.
Oh, cool.
Quotations.
That was a great time.
Yeah. Anyway, the cop thing, I think you're kind of missing a big point as far as Republicans are concerned, because the one guy mentioned how they were against the union, the police unions expanding, which the cops program does. But when you do that, when you expand the police at that level, you expand the unions, you expand the economic base at the bottom, which is what we want to do.
Right.
And it's what the Republicans don't want to do.
Right. So that's why the Republicans would rather, if they're going to spend $20 million in a Cleveland police department enhancing it, they don't want to spend that $20 million in an area where it's going to build the union out by adding more people. They want to spend that $20 million on, you know, new and fancy guns or some variation thereof. That makes perfect sense. Douglas, thank you for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. Excellent point. You know, this is why they go after teachers, because they're unionized. It's why they went after the post office. It's the largest union employer in America. Duh.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Republicans hate unions and always have. They support big business and always have. This is just, I mean, this is kind of political science 101. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, which is offering a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of the war in South Sudan. You can get that at GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Louise wears one. She's very fond of it. They're beautiful. Victoria Jones, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Nice to see you. So what's going on in the world today?
Well, a lot of things are going on today. Actually, we've got lots of bits of news. Start out, I'm going to mention the Benghazi hearing in the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. I say I'm going to mention it because I imagine that you have talked about it. And the test, if I were to go into the details of the testimony, I would take all our time. And it's really a case of he said, he said, he said, she said, and only one side of the he said is here.
Right. My understanding is that there were no bombshells. There were no revelations in the hearings today.
There's really been nothing new, partly because some of the testimony was released by Chairman Daryl Issa ahead of time. It's certainly been a very emotional day because some of the witnesses have been very emotional.
Right.
And
family members and things like this.
Yeah, so yeah. It's been a very emotional day. Whether it's moved the ball any further along in terms of finding things out. I don't know that.
Well, I don't think they're interested in finding things out. I think they're interested. I mean, Mike Huckabee on the radio said that they're interested in using this to impeach Obama. I think that they're interested in smearing Hillary Clinton so that if she runs for president, they'll have pre-smeared her.
I think that politically, for some, doing both would not be a bad day's work.
Sure. Sure. What else is up?
Well, lawmakers across Capitol Hill have gone ballistic over the issue of sexual assault in the military. And there were hearings today on other issues, appropriations hearings, budget hearings. But Air Force Chief of Staff was there. Somebody from the Coast Guard was there. And so they had to deal with this issue instead. And you've got lawmakers, bipartisan lawmakers, putting forward some very interesting legislation. Senators Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, Kelly Ayotte, Republican of New Hampshire, they've got a bill that they've introduced that would provide victims of sexual assault with a special military lawyer and change some of the procedures for courts martial in the chase of sexual assault charges.
Mm-hmm.
They think the chain of command needs to change, and they grilled the Air Force Chief of Staff today. Murray saying, we don't want to be sitting here 20 years from now with the same statistics.
Right.
Next week, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat of New York, is going to introduce controversial legislation, at least within the Pentagon, that would replace the current system of adjudicating sexual assault within the military by taking the cases outside the victim's chain of command and putting it under the jurisdiction of prosecutors.
You mean civilian prosecutors?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting.
And in the House, Representatives Mike Turner, Republican of Ohio, and Nikki Tsongas, Democrat of Massachusetts, have got legislation that they're sponsoring that would strip an officer's authority to change or dismiss a court martial in major cases like sexual assault, and also require that an individual found guilty in those cases and some other offenses be either dismissed or dishonorably discharged.
Ultimately, I think this all comes down to the culture within the military, and it's going to take a whole bunch of different tweaks and changes to reorient the military so that it is harder for men to get away with this. It is easier for women, and it's by and large women who are the victims of it, not always. It's easier for women to be taken seriously and not be none of the blame the victim stuff that's going on today, and. This is all good stuff. This is all good news to me.
It's good to have some good news. President Obama's cabinet picks continue to face difficult paths. Two things today. Thomas Perez was supposed to be voted on today. He's the pick for Labor Secretary. Senate Health Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions was to vote on him today, but it didn't. Why? Well, because Republicans, surprisingly, invoked a Senate rule preventing committees from meeting for more than 2 hours after the Senate is gaveled in on a given day.
What? They used a technicality, basically, to say,
yes, they did.
We're going to block your nomination for Labor Secretary.
And they've wanted to block him, and there was a big hearing in the House about him yesterday because they really strongly oppose him over a number of issues, including his role in arranging a deal last year to try to avert a Supreme Court ruling on a particular legal theory used to enforce civil rights laws. Also, President Obama's EPA pick, Gina McCarthy. She, you know, you normally get questions before a hearing. Senator David Vitter, Louisiana Republican with close ties to the gas and oil industries, has sent 653 questions.
Wow.
It's a record.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the oil companies must have hired, you know, dozens and dozens of lawyers just to write those questions.
I don't know how you come up with that many questions. I don't know 653 things.
Yeah, that's amazing. How old were you when you got your first dog? What was your third grade teacher's name? What possibly could they? Well,
and of course, he won't like her answers.
Yeah, well, I mean, what they're betting on is that if there's 653 questions that she has to answer, that it's going to take her months just to answer them. And so
I think she won't. Also, Jeffrey Skilling, former Enron chief executive, has reached a deal with the Justice Department to lop off as much as 10 years from his prison sentence to 14 years.
What's he giving up?
Well, he's given up his rights to any further appeals, as well as to allow more than 40 million of forfeited assets to be distributed to victims of the collapsed energy giant.
Huh. Interesting. Okay, yeah. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
And this brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. We will be back right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. What do you get when you have a for-profit healthcare system like the one we have here in the United States that not one single other of the 33 OECD countries has? What do you get? You get one hospital in Washington, D.C. that charges $115,000 to keep a patient on a ventilator. And another hospital in the same city that charges just under $53,000 for the exact same thing. You get one hospital in Miami that charges $166,000 for treating a heart attack with four stents and major complications. And another hospital in that city that charges around $89,000 for the same thing. For years, we weren't able to get a clear picture of what various hospitals charge for similar procedures. Hospitals had gone out of their way for years to hide what's called their procedure price lists, like they were national secrets. But not anymore, because the cat's finally out of the bag. Today, the Obama administration and the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services released a database that shows for the first time how much the vast majority of hospitals in our country charge for the 100 most common inpatient procedures billed to Medicare. And when they released that data, you know, this is all the claims for 2011, 163,000 individual charges recorded at more than 3,300 hospitals in 306 metropolitan areas. And the numbers paint a picture of a totally insane system. The prices for the exact treatments vary all over the map and at random at hospitals, sometimes just a few city blocks from each other. Look at hospital costs in and around New York City, for example. The Huffington Post compiled data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services report to make a map of hospital costs for treating chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, in the New York metropolitan area, the range of costs to treat the same exact disease is where people, well, it's more deep, it's more extensive than people just get out of breath very easily, but that's the main symptom. But COPD, it's going to be a very serious condition. At the Bayonne Hospital Center, just over the Hudson River in New Jersey, treatment of COPD costs $99,690. Right across the river, back in New York City, at the hospital on the tip of Manhattan, that same treatment is $11,000. Looking at the entire New York City metropolitan area, the cost of COPD treatment ranges from $7,000 at a hospital in the Bronx to that $99,690 charged at the Bayonne Hospital Center. And it's all the same treatment. In major cities across our nation, the range of prices for similar or the identical medical procedures looks more like the ups and downs of a wildly volatile stock market. I mean, you know, it's important to note here, by the way, that these prices that are revealed in this data do not reflect the prices that Medicare and insurance actually pay for the various procedures. Medicare and insurance companies pay what are called negotiated rates for the procedures. So they pretty much pay the same everywhere. Instead, what these numbers tell us is what the 49 million uninsured human beings, people in our country, citizens of the United States, have to pay for these various procedures out of their own pockets because they don't have insurance. They didn't negotiate a deal with the insurance, with the hospitals. This data represents the dilemma that uninsured Americans face when they're basically trying to decide between, do I save my life by having this procedure done and live a life of poverty, or die? But the real takeaway from this new data should be just how absurd and crazy it is to have a for-profit health system. I mean, this is nuts. We used to have a largely not-for-profit system, not-for-profit hospitals, not-for-profit insurance companies. These are mainly required by the various states' hospital and insurance regulatory boards. Then in 1980, Ronald Reagan stepped into the White House, and basically everything changed. Nonprofit and community-owned became evil, and for-profit and corporate-owned became good, and it was all about making a buck. Insurance companies and hospitals throughout the 80s and the 90s began turning into for-profit money-making machines. Doctors began forming their own practices as corporate entities, and physician costs began to soar. Prescription drug companies began to squeeze every last penny out of the American public. And, you know, they cut that deal with Bush where, Medicare can no longer negotiate prices for drugs. So the cost of just about every other aspect of healthcare in the United States has skyrocketed since the Reagan era. And what we're left with is a for-profit, basically a Reaganomics healthcare system that charges inexplicable rates for common everyday procedures and lets prescription drug companies fleece the wallets of Americans while millions are forced to decide between life-saving health care or a life of poverty. Actually, they're forced to decide between life-saving health care and a life of poverty or death. If health care were part of the commons, if we were to say that health care is a right in America instead of just a privilege, none of this would be happening. We wouldn't have a hospital in the Bronx, New York, charging $7,000 for a treatment, and a hospital a few miles away charging thousands more for the same procedure. It is time. We must say in America, we're taking the healthcare system out of the hands of the corporate profiteers and the Wall Street tycoons, and we're putting it back where it belongs, in the hands of the American people. You know, Alan Grayson so nailed this thing when he said the Republican plan is don't get sick. And if you do get sick, die quick because it's less expensive. That's what we've got. It's really quite remarkable, but that's what we've got. The NRA, by the way, they've got a magazine for young people. And they are telling kids how to build their own shooting ranges. I guess you'd expect that. And then of all the bizarre things for sale, Amazon just pulled this because people were yelling about it. But it was featured at the NRA convention this last weekend. where they had a figure that looked very much like Obama. You shoot it, it bleeds. They also had a woman, and you shoot her with a very low-cut dress on. You shoot her, and she bleeds. They called her the ex-girlfriend. And Amazon was actually selling these things until recently, and they pulled it. It's like, you think our gun culture, you think the small penis gun club was just a weird joke? I think our misogyny and our gun fetishes and our desire for empire and our constant drumbeat of fear and all, I think that they all, you can tie these things all together. You can tie them all together. Channel 5 in Madison, Wisconsin, did a special on a police officer who was doing community policing. Here's a little clip from it.
Officer Katie Adler starts her day like most other cops.
Coming to work, checking my email.
But it doesn't last long.
This is Packer Townhouse apartment complex.
The complex is one of a half dozen under Adler's watch, and one she patrols on her own two wheels. Her presence isn't always expected.
So they caught the police?
Did they what?
Call the police?
Oh, no. No one called the police. We just came here. You know, I like to walk around, see you guys and stuff.
There are nearly 600 apartment units on her beat, and it's rare to find someone she doesn't know.
I don't think I've ever met you, though, before. What is your name?
Arthur.
Arthur, nice to meet you. I'm Officer Katie.
Those she knows well follow her.
I'm like the Pied Piper sometimes. That's okay, though.
Even though Officer Katie doesn't have any kids of her own, she has plenty here.
I love you.
That love is for Marie Nofaji, whose connection with the cop comes over a shared passion. Marie wants to be a police officer. Their bond led to a job shadow.
Some kids, or even other people, they have like a bad perspective on police officers, and like they do this and they do that, and all they care is about getting people in trouble. But she gives a perspective of like, not all of them are like that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is my point. You know, if you see the police officers in the neighborhood, you get to know them. The kids are going to want to grow up to be cops too. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. 20 minutes past the hour. Okay, Christian terrorists, the KKK, the oldest Christian terrorist organization in America, arguably, although Christianity was invoked by the pilgrims, by John Bradford, for killing Indians in the 1640s, as I recall. And the idea that, you know, if you're a Muslim in another country and we drop bombs on you and kill you and you're not a combatant, you might think of us as terrorists, particularly when our politicians proclaim their Christianity so loudly. Rodney in Chicago Heights, Illinois. Listening on WCPT. Hey, Rodney.
Tom, how are you doing? Happy belated, by the way.
Thank you.
And Daryl Issa, I think it's not that well thought out. It's just a broader campaign to keep his base stirred up. I'm talking about the mouth breathers that are devotees of Fox News and Rush and Limbaugh and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just flinging stuff at the wall. If it happens to the stare of the president or Hillary, that's just something he can hang his head on, whatever sticks.
Yeah.
And you pose the question as to who the terrorists are. Well, in my humble opinion, the terrorists are the banksters and the corporations that are allowed to buy our legislators, our military, and public officials at wholesale prices.
Now, why does that produce terror? You know, I agree those are the corruptors of our system, but why does that produce terror?
Because they have to have a boogeyman to justify spending all this money.
Yeah. I would say,
all these weapon systems and militarizing the police and,
right.
You know.
Yeah. Another way to say this is how that's terrorism is that you have so many Americans right now who are just a couple paychecks away from, or an illness away from, basically losing everything. And they are virtually living their entire lives in terror. And that's the terror of, there's been inflicted in this country by 32 years of Reaganomics.
Yeah, and I'm one of them. You was talking about the, you know, the corporate, you know, for-profit insurance. Now, if we had universal care, I could actually get, as a chronic pain sufferer, I could get the treatment that I needed so I could be a productive person and, you know, try to get disability. You know, you get denied, and, you know. So, you know, I'm living on $1,600 a month only because I had a pension, thank God.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good for that. But I'm with you, Rodney. We've got a lot of Americans in the United States who are living lives of, you know, what was the old phrase, quiet desperation, living lives of quiet desperation. I forget who said it. And that desperation in some cases becomes quiet terror. Rodney, thank you for the call. Well said. Alfred in Fairlawn, New Jersey. Alfred, what's up?
Well, yes, I'm a first-time caller. The largest Christian terrorist group in the United States, by definition, wouldn't that be the Republican Party?
I'm not going to go there. I mean, it would give
me
cheap headlines.
The orange threat level, the red threat level, the George Bush years, where everybody was afraid. And
George Bush was certainly exploiting fear in the 2004 election, and Tom Ridge came out later and talked about that, how he as director of Homeland Security was being told to raise by the White House to raise the threat level, but didn't know why during the campaign. And basically, you go back and you look at it and you track it. Every time Kerry got some good press, boom, the threat level would go up, and so the press would stop paying attention to John Kerry and start paying attention to the threat and all that kind of thing. That certainly happened. I mean, you know, I don't think that makes them necessarily terrorists. That makes them people who are exploiting other terrorists, the actions of other terrorists.
Yeah, they're exploiting fear.
Yeah, yeah. But fear and terror, I think that we need to be careful not to dilute these words. You know, it's like, you know, referring to Holocausts and things. We need to be careful not to dilute certain words. And I think that the word terrorist was badly diluted and badly abused by the Bush administration. And I'm so very pleased that for 6 years now, going on 5 years, that Barack Obama has been in president, he has not been using the phrase war on terror. And although he has used the word terrorist more often than he probably should, and there have been times when he's gone out of his way not to use it, and then the right wingers yell and scream. You know, Benghazi was an example. You were hearing his yell and scream, and okay, all right, it's an act of terror. But it's like, come on. I think that we need to be very, very careful on this. But your point is well made, Alfred. Thank you. They are using fear. Maybe fearists. How's that? Nick in New Windsor, New York. Nonprofit healthcare?
No, I was just playing, for no particular reason. I was just wondering if you had ever heard of any good aspects of for-profit healthcare. Not because I'm necessarily a proponent of it. I'm just playing devil's advocate and kind of wanted to get your take on it.
Well, there's the corporate forms are different. When you have a nonprofit corporation, its purpose for existence is to do whatever it is to do. You know, the Hunter School at hunterschool.org, their purpose for existence is teaching kids who are, you know, neurologically challenged, who have ADHD or Asperger's and, you know, that kind of thing. And so, you know, all the decisions that the management makes there are made through the lens of what's going to be best to help these kids. On the other hand, if you have a for-profit school, and the name of one doesn't come to mind, but let's say a for-profit charter school or whatever, every decision that they make is going to be made in the through the lens of what's going to increase shareholder equity, what's going to make the most money for us. Now, if teaching people well makes the most money, that arguably is a good thing, but for-profit institutions carry with them certain loads that nonprofit organizations don't have. You have to pay out dividends to the stockholders. You have to pay marketing expenses. You have to compete against other for-profits, and there are expenses associated with that. So, no, I have no good argument for a for-profit healthcare system. I don't think it should exist. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think personally that health care, just like education, should be a right and not a privilege. I go back to Franklin Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights. The good, the bad, and the very, very longa-caudily ugly, the good. Jack Lew. At a speaking event in Cleveland Tuesday, the new Treasury Secretary criticized austerity economics and called for new efforts to solve our nation's ongoing unemployment crisis. He said, important as the deficit is, it cannot be our guiding star. Deficit reduction alone is not an economic policy. We have to apply the same sense of urgency to expanding our economy and getting people back to work. End of quote. Couldn't have said it better myself, Mr. Secretary. Although Lew is only 3 months into his tenure as head of the Treasury Department, his comments yesterday bode well for the future. Let's just hope Republicans in Congress get the message. The bad. Ava Lipkin. During an appearance on VCY America's Crosstalk program yesterday, the conservative conspiracy theorist warned of a Muslim plot orchestrated by the president to confiscate and resettle our national parks. Sometimes hearing is believing. Take a listen.
They go to the country where the president is a Muslim of a Christian country. That's Obama. That's the U.S. You've heard of Agenda 21, right?
Absolutely.
Agenda 21 means the U.S. government can confiscate national parks, national forests, resources, big farms. You're going to have tens of millions of Muslims abandoning the Middle East, which is being turned into complete desolation by these civil wars. And the ultimate goal is to have a Muslim majority in America.
All right. I'm pretty sure it's actually the oil companies that are trying to confiscate national park land. But, you know, you're entitled to your tinfoil hat, Avi. And the very, very ugly Rush Limbaugh's. What a surprise, huh? In the wake of the arrest of three brothers suspected of holding three Cleveland women hostage for over a decade, many have wondered what could possibly have driven that trio to such unspeakable acts. Rush Limbaugh thinks welfare made them do it.
Three brothers, but not related to the three women, have been arrested in Cleveland, which voted Obama. Not that that's got anything to do with anything. One of who has the baby? Double welfare benefits if one of the women has a baby. No, I don't know. I just wanted, fascinating to hear the same thing happened last night on Hawaii 5-0.
Don't pretend you don't know what you're saying, Rush. You do. Also, you're basing your theories on an episode of Hawaii 5-0? That's just very, very ugly. Oh, my. Joanne, in Southport, Connecticut, you know the earliest case of terrorism?
Well, in 1493, May 4th, actually, Pope Alexander VI decreed in his bull, Inter Caetera, that all lands west and south of a certain meridian line would belong to Spain. And then that was reaffirmed later when Portugal protested, and the Pope Julius II in 1506 reconfirmed Spain's rights to all of the western hemisphere of this certain line, right, west of the Cape Verde Islands,
right,
and granted Portugal everything east with the edict and right to murder all the pagans and natives of these lands in the name of the Christian God.
Whoa. Wow. Okay, you sound like you've done your homework.
I'm studying the law and the brutality of laws and the history of laws and how laws twist down with the same stereotypes,
yeah,
and hatreds in small groups, and yeah, even as it comes into our own country as judicial law and emissaries of kings.
Yeah, well, this has certainly happened here. Joanne, thank you for sharing that with us.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Patrick in Alberta, Canada. Hey, Patrick. Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. What's up?
Thanks, Tom. Hope you're well.
I'm fine. By the way, I saw, if you can just verify this for me, I'm pretty sure it was in the New York Times today, I saw that Alberta, Canada has had a tax on carbon since 2007. Is that true?
Yep.
Uh-huh. And we
I mean, it's kind of hidden. You don't see it, but yeah, there's a carbon tax.
Amazing. And yet we're going to take your oil sludge and bring it down here and refine it, and but we can't get a carbon tax down here. It's amazing.
Well, I wouldn't call, be careful. That's not sludge. That is, in fact, bitumen, and it really is oil. I mean,
yeah.
It's not pretend oil. It's not fake oil. It's the real deal.
Yeah.
Now that you bring it up, there's a kind of a standing joke in the community, because I'm in that community, that we're just cleaning up nature's largest oil spill.
and dumping it in South Texas.
Okay. No, they're not dumping it. They're buying it from us. You know, you are capitalist after all.
You're right.
Anyway, on that point, I just got 3 points. I've been listening to you in the satellite in my truck because I drive all the time. You know, 3 things. Number one, you need to nationalize your health care, reduce the for-profit motive. You'll either reduce your costs by 10 to 20% or increase your services by 10 to 20%.
I agree.
That's a no-brainer.
Probably closer to 50% because, you know, Canada, it's about half of ours.
Well, yeah, our total GDP expenditure on healthcare is half of yours.
Yeah.
I mean, people don't see that. And I go down the states a fair bit, and they say, well, taxes, taxes. I go, okay, so I spend 15 cents a liter more on gas than you do by the gallon. But look at our healthcare. We don't have people going bankrupt just because they're having a heart attack, right?
Right.
And one of my contract employees had a heart attack and had to have a couple of stints put in, and 90 days later, he's back on the road, good as new, and paying $90 a month for his health care.
Wow.
You know, so actually, we don't pay it in Alberta, but that's the effective cost of it.
Yeah.
The other thing is, you need to license gun owners and not guns.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have that here, because I've been hearing on the show. I didn't know if you knew that or not.
No, I didn't know that.
In Canada, in order to buy ammunition and or firearms, you have to have what's called a firearms acquisition certificate, which is a knowledge-based deal. You have to take a course and you have to pass a test.
So it's like having a driver's license before you can drive a car.
Yeah, pretty much. Yep.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, license, you know, and restrict handguns, that's a whole other conversation.
So, Patrick, it sounds to me like what you're suggesting, these 3 suggestions that you've made.
The other one is,
okay,
your corporations have to pay their fair share of taxes, and they have to be quick, they have to be legislated to stop laundering money to their offshore corporation so they pay the appropriate level of tax.
Do you have that problem in Canada?
No.
No? Canadian corporations can't set up offshore operations in the Cayman Islands and not pay taxes?
Oh, they can set them up in the Cayman Islands and whatnot, but it's still, Canadian corporations don't have that issue. They pay reasonable taxes.
Huh.
So, you know,
the solution is the United States should simply, like, merge with Canada.
No. I spent enough time down there to go, no.
Where are you? Shano says, where you're Mexicans.
You're great people, and I love traveling there, and I spend a month a year down in Idaho,
uh-huh,
which has the highest population of white supremacists, right?
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
You never see them, but, you know, wonderful people. I love the travel. I love going to the States. Address those 3 things and a whole bunch of your other problems go away, right?
I think you're absolutely right.
Saying, license the owners, not the guns, because that's always the deal. Don't license my gun, right?
Yeah.
We had a gun registry in Canada and a total complete disaster. Even the police wouldn't enforce the law.
Yeah.
That tells you how bad it is.
Yeah.
And the other thing is healthcare. Healthcare is a basic human right.
It should be. It is in every other developed country in the world except the United States. Here it's a privilege.
Well, I go to Mexico as well, right?
Right.
I get great health care in Mexico.
Yeah.
My wife stepped on a sea urchin in, the Mayan Riviera.
Mm-hmm.
Cost us $100 to see a resort doctor trained in Mexico City, a great guy, and gave us some drugs and said, try these, and you go to the pharmacia and you buy the drugs over the counter, and they're cheap.
Yeah.
So if you guys aren't, as good as Mexico, the guys you're trying to keep out,
Yeah, we got a problem. We got a problem. Patrick, as an American, let me thank you as a good Canadian for offering us your thoughts and insights and wisdom. I think you're absolutely right. Appreciate the call. Thank you, Patrick. And thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. Peggy in Carbondale, Illinois. Hey, Peggy, Milton Friedman, really?
Hi. I hear you, and this is my first call in, too.
I hear you talk about Reaganomics.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder why you never mention Milton Friedman.
Because most people don't know who he was.
Well, he was a Nobel Prize winner.
Sort of. They invented the... It's not an actual Nobel Prize. The economics prize is not given by the Nobel Society out of Norway. It's given by a bank in Sweden. And they started that so that they would have an excuse to give a prize in memory of Alfred Nobel to Milton Friedman to elevate his status. Because back in the 50s and 60s, everybody was laughing at him, the poor professor from Chicago. Anyway,
well,
you were saying.
I don't know why they didn't stop laughing.
I'm with you.
Because he has been the bane of our economic system.
Oh, yeah.
And Reagan picked right up on it, and it's been that way ever since.
Yep, Reaganomics is Friedmanomics. And the other thing is, sometimes when I talk about Milton Friedman, people think I'm talking about Thomas Friedman. And there are some differences. I mean, Thomas Friedman, I think, is a little wackadoodle when it comes to things like foreign trade policies and things. But Milton Friedman, yes, he was the father of the whole thing. You're absolutely right, Peggy. And although you could talk about Hayek and von Mises as well, but Friedman was the guy here in the United States, and he was the one who went down to Chile and said, "Oh, we'll help you out," and you know, help out dictators around the world, and just created some real messes. Thank you, Peggy, for the call. Excellent point. We will be back 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What does it take to be a terrorist? Chuck asked that question. We'll get to that. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. And pleased to be with you, Tom Hartman, here with you on the True People's Media. Chuck, in Houston, Texas. Hey, Chuck, thanks for listening to Sirius. You are wondering, does it require violence to be a terrorist? What do you mean by that?
Well, we've had this debate about whether the NRA convention was here and are they a terrorist organization? And then someone said, well, then my insurance company is a terrorist organization because right. They say, if you don't buy insurance, here's the fear that I'm selling you.
Right.
So we kind of ties it to a concept of you're using fear to achieve your agenda.
Right.
So then someone said, well, by that, then almost anybody, a car salesman is a terrorist organization, which some of them may be, that being said. So then you said, well, we're trying to codify something that maybe isn't that, maybe it's like pornography. I know it when I see it.
Right. Well, this is why I was cautioning an earlier caller that we be careful about using the word terrorist, that we use it when we really mean terrorist, that the word should have some impact and some very, very specific meaning. I would say that somebody is a terrorist.
Right? It really does.
I beg your pardon?
It gets diluted otherwise. It doesn't have
exactly.
The impact that we want it to have of meaning. This is something we should really pay attention to.
Right, and we should really avoid, and we should really understand the causes of. And my definition of a terrorist is somebody who is willing to kill absolutely innocent civilians in order to terrorize a larger populace. And that would include the KKK killing absolutely innocent blacks in order to terrorize other blacks, or killing Jews or Catholics for that matter.
Absolutely. Once you cross that violence line to achieve your goal, it seems most human people at least.
Yeah, I think that the important piece of it has to be that you're willing to kill, that a terrorist is somebody who's willing to kill somebody who is not a combatant. And that's what differentiates. I think that there are a lot of people that we have identified as terrorists who in their minds are not terrorists. They are combatants. They are fighting a war. They're fighting against aggression. I think that if when George Bush was president and he was doing all this crazy stuff, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and torturing and everything, if the government of Canada had said, you know, your president has gone crazy down there in America, he's got weapons of mass destruction, he's got nuclear bombs, we're going to invade America and we're going to arrest George Bush and put him in prison, and thousands of Mounties came across the border, a Canadian army came across the border to arrest George Bush, I would probably be out there trying to stop them. It is.
Well, we might have had better health care, though.
We might have. But my point is that many of these people in these Muslim countries where we started phony wars because they happen to have an enormous amount of oil, Iraq specifically, many of these people who are fighting back against us do not think of themselves as terrorists, and many of them really have no interest at all in killing innocent American civilians. They will kill an American soldier. They view themselves as warriors, as combatants. And I think that's a very different thing.
They're responding the same way as we would if a force had arrived here.
I think they are responding the same way we would.
Yeah, and it's hard to then say we would be terrorists.
Although the British called us that, you know, in the 1770s, because we refused to fight. George Washington's army would not fight by standing in a line like the British did. Instead, they'd shoot from behind the trees, and the British said, that's not fair, that's terrorism.
In Afghanistan, I think we call that irony.
I guess so.
I learned so much listening to your show. I appreciate it.
Chuck, thanks for the thought-provoking call. I appreciate it myself. Gus, listening on WWRL in New York City. Hey, Gus, you wanted to talk about the big banks?
Yeah, well, you know, maybe it's more like economic terrorism or emotional terrorism. But I think the way that the economy has forced, parents to both work over the decades has really harmed, like, the physiology of our children. And I don't know if you've ever interviewed Dr. Gabor Maté, but...
yes, I have.
Clinical research... Right. He has, you know, these really interesting reports that suggest that, wartime stress really causes weakness and makes people susceptible to addiction.
Gabor Maté was the guy who, in fact, on this program, he's the one who informed me about cortisol, that children, when they're in the womb developing, they're constantly, you know, still inside mom. They're constantly asking mom, am I going to be born into a safe world or a dangerous world? And mom is constantly answering chemically by her cortisol levels, by her hormone levels that are associated with anxiety. And if she has high levels of anxiety, thus high levels of cortisol, then the baby will develop more fight or flight mechanism, hindbrain stuff, and less thinking, compassion, music, whatever, forebrain stuff. And on the other hand, if she has very low levels of cortisol, low levels of stress throughout her pregnancy, the baby will develop more forebrain stuff, and you'll have an Albert Einstein baby rather than a warrior baby, and less hindbrain stuff. So, yeah.
Right, and if you want to fast forward a little bit, I'm a school teacher, and I can tell you, I teach in the inner city, and I can tell you that the kids, as they get older, they're still just as stressed as ever, and that manifests itself in, all kinds of ADHD, ADHD, but it's really just kids that are, you know, putting up all kinds of red flags saying that something's not right, you know,
right.
And especially when it comes to all this testing, you know, it's just been crazy the last couple of weeks with the testing. So, it's a shame, it's a pity, and I think we need more time, more family time. You know, like paid leave and stuff like that, because it's really an investment in the child.
Yeah, and we need to get back to an economy where two people can be together and one of them can work and the other can watch the kids if they choose. It needs to be a choice, of course, but for most, it's not a choice anymore. Thank you, Gus. Thanks for listening to WWRL. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest news and information on what's happening in Congress this week. It's getting stranger and stranger. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get over to pdamerica.org and sign up. Go over to movetoamend.org. Check out free-don.com. Get out there and do something. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.